From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, what's ahead for Michigan now that it's getting harder to find arms for vaccine doses?
I think the real moonshot is we need to start taking the vaccine to people and consider vaccinating them on their doorsteps.
Also, the head of an Arab Muslim community organization talks about mobilizing for that very purpose.
We really are using the trust that the community put in us to make sure that the community has access to the vaccine.
And an advocate for psilocybin talks about the case for legal microdosing in Michigan.
It's an emerging tool that can be very useful for healing an array of mental health challenges or issues or conditions.
Those stories and more coming up. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today on the show, we're going to speak with an advocate for psilocybin microdosing. One Michigan city has already decriminalized psychedelics. Could a wider movement be far behind?
Within 3 to 5 years, this will be really a mainstream part of our medical model.
That's coming up later in the show. But first, we wanted to talk about how the pandemic prognosis might be changing. A couple of months ago, the biggest vaccine problem for Michiganders was finding one. If you were able to wait next to a computer, hitting refresh on the signups, you might have been lucky enough to snag an appointment. But now the state is facing an opposite challenge, finding people who are ready to sign up for the healthy supply of doses we have available. What does this mean for our ability to return to some kind of normal? Is herd immunity even possible anymore? And what would it take to get there? Here to talk us through some of this is Deborah Verholden. She's an associate dean and a professor of public health at Michigan State University, and she's also director of the Flint Center for Health Equity Solutions. Deborah, welcome back to Stateside.
Hey, thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here.
You know, we're at this point in the pandemic where some of our mass vaccination sites are potentially winding their work down because there aren't enough people signing up to sustain extremely large operations. How should public health officials be thinking about shifting their strategy to reach the people who aren't going to make it to the mass vaccination sites?
So I think there was tremendous benefit with these mass vaccination sites. It did deal with a lot of the barriers that people had to getting the shot in the arm. I think what we're starting to see now is we've gotten what we're going to get from that strategy. So now it's time to go another level. If you actually talk to people and say, what are your barriers? People will say things like, I know a lot of people who said they want the shot and are still stuck in the maze on a wait list. They have to call and make an appointment. So what we've seen in communities now are things like appointment-free vaccination sites where you can just simply show up. And they're not just at the mass vaccination sites. They're in local community sites, in churches, in smaller pharmacies, in community centers, in places like that. And then I think the real moonshot and where we need to go next is we need to start taking the vaccine to people and consider vaccinating them on their doorsteps.
Indeed. Let's do a basic refresher. What do we mean when we're talking about herd immunity? How much of our population might need to be vaccinated or have survived infection to reach that point?
So herd immunity, which is also called community immunity, is this sweet spot in public health where you have a sufficient enough proportion of the population who's immune from infection such that the likelihood of an infected person coming in contact with and transmitting a disease to a person who is susceptible or at risk of infection becomes really, really low. It's a numbers game. And there's no exact percentage. And it varies a bit from disease to disease. But roughly what we think is it's going to be somewhere on an order of a minimum of about 70% of our population. And predictably, it'll be closer to something like 85%. Of the population will need to be immunized or immune from COVID before we can get to herd immunity.
When public health folks talk about this stuff, do they assume that that percentage changes as the virus mutates?
So this is an interesting thing, because if we talk about immunity, there's two types of immunity. There's immunity that you get from infection and recovery, and then there's vaccine-induced immunity. It's more complicated in the case of COVID because what we're finding is that immunity, the duration of immunity varies. It looks like people who are vaccinated have a longer immune response and protection compared to people who actually contract the virus and then recover. And so we've got to somehow factor into this the duration of immunity. And like you mentioned, another complicating factor is what does immunity look like as the virus continues to mutate? And then we have these variant strains, which in some cases appear to be the dominant strains that may not have the same response to the current vaccines. And people who even have natural immunity might not have the same level of protection against a variant strain that they would against an original strain. So it's a complicated sort of algorithm, if you will, that's constantly evolving. So to get to herd immunity, we have to do it quickly and get spread down so that some of these other factors don't have us in a never-ending cycle of surges.
I wanted to ask you some questions specific to Genesee County. As of Saturday, the percentage of folks who've received at least one dose of a COVID vaccine was at 43%. And the rate of folks who were fully vaccinated stands closer to 30%. This seems to suggest we had a bit of a spike of vaccinations once all adults were eligible. How close do you think the Flint metro area is going to get to the percentile that we think of as herd immunity?
So we have a goal very similar to the state goal of 70% vaccinated by the end of the year. I think we're gonna be able to get there, but it's going to require a lot of work. You know, so I think what we saw in the initial phases, and this stands true for Genesee County and all across the country, is the people who wanted the vaccine, most of them have raised their hand. They're somehow in the process of getting it. They've either gotten one or both doses. They're on a wait list or they have an appointment. What we're dealing with now are the people who want it, but are still having barriers to getting it, whether it be transportation, whether it be complicating medical conditions. So they're still sort of trying to figure out, you know, when and how. I myself have a pregnant daughter, and we're trying to figure out what's the sweet spot during her pregnancy to get that vaccine. There's all these sort of factors that are at play, but it is going to require a different set of strategies. I think what we're seeing in the waning numbers is the return on those initial investments and the initial strategies. We're starting to see we've gotten what we're going to get from that. Now it's time to innovate even further.
You know, Governor Whitmer made an announcement last week that was intended to tie the reopening of various aspects of life in Michigan to those vaccination rates. We've seen some communities putting financial incentives into place. How effective do you think the carrots might be in getting folks to their dose?
So I do believe that the vaccine has the potential to be a game changer for the pandemic. It has that potential. The problem that I see is twofold. Number one, we flattened the curve earlier in the pandemic in the absence of a vaccine. We did that with good public health, and we did that with prevention. The vaccine was supposed to come in addition to all of those other layers of protection and be the thing that tipped the scale. The mistake that we made is we started to peel back some of those other strategies that had us flatten the curve in the first place, expecting the vaccine to carry an undue burden of helping us turn the tides. It should have happened in addition to all of the good public health and prevention strategies. But replacing some of those strategies with the vaccine, I do think was a mistake. Tethering it to reopening, I think is that's a tricky one.
I think I'm hearing you say that you need both the carrot and some kind of stick there.
You need a carrot and you need a stick. And I don't want to downplay the very valid concerns that all people might have about the vaccine. A lot of people just have ongoing questions. And it's our job to make sure that they get those questions answered. Giving them a little bit of a nudge, you know, dangling that carrot out there is a good thing, but it will not, to me, undermine or undo the need for good COVID literacy and health literacy so that people are making well-informed choices that they feel good about. I do believe people deserve that.
Yeah. How do you think about public health shifting strategies overall if herd immunity is out of reach? If we find ourselves in a position where we say, we're not really going to be back to normal anytime in the foreseeable future.
I think we need a much better narrative. And we started off strong about the power of public health. And it's unfortunate because in this tough political climate, political views and political will and people's freedoms have gotten intertangled with public health in a way where public health has almost taken a back seat. Early on in the pandemic, it was all we had. Everybody was sort of up in arms and we were all really concerned. And so we sort of pushed public health to the forefront. But I think people have gotten weathered. They've become COVID fatigued. They're over it and they just want to get back to normal. What I want people to understand is this is now with us. COVID will likely be endemic in the human population. So us understanding the best combined strategies to keep this thing at bay is something that we're going to have to figure out and manage likely for the rest of time. And so I think we need to do that work now. And honestly, while I can understand people wanting to return to normal, if we don't do better, this might be what normal looks like, this never-ending cycle of things opening and closing and variants and booster vaccines and all of these other things. We missed the mark in just arresting this thing in its tracks.
Overall, do you feel optimistic about Michigan getting to herd immunity?
Yes, this herd immunity issue is really an important one. And the thing about us getting to herd immunity is we've got to have a significant proportion of the population immune at the same time. And because immunity, it looks like wanes, it's important that we get people vaccinated now. For herd immunity to really work, we've got to have it happen in a very short period of time so we can stop the spread of this virus. In the absence of that, we really are going to be in a never-ending cycle.
Deborah Verholden is director of the Flint Center for Health Equity Solutions and an associate dean and professor of public health at MSU. Deborah, it's great to hear your voice. Stay safe.
Thanks.
In just a moment, an update from a community group that's vaccinated more than 20,000 people in Michigan's Arab and Muslim communities. Hassan Jaber of Dearborn-based Access joins us after a short break. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. We just heard a bit about how the public health sector might need to adjust its ideas about the pandemic and about what it will mean to move forward and get back to something we all consider normal. It's becoming increasingly clear that the next mile of public health challenges will rely heavily on community organizations. We thought immediately about Access. The Arab Community Center for Economic and Social Services in Dearborn has leaned way in during the pandemic, adapting its existing programs for community wellness to some rapidly changing circumstances. Hassan Jaber is president and CEO of Access, and he joins us now. Hi, Hassan. Welcome back to Stateside.
Hello, April. And it's really good to be with you.
Access was an early community provider of COVID testing, and you were able to reach a very respectable 15,000 people and counting with tests. Has it been possible to pivot that healthcare infrastructure to vaccinate people for COVID?
And the latest figures, April, is we're closing in on 20,000 vaccinations, and we're doing it through our clinics in Dearborn. We're doing it through our clinic in Sterling Heights in Macomb County. And also we're doing these evening clinics to accommodate people working during daytime. So, also to accommodate Muslims fasting during the month of Ramadan. We really are using the trust that the community put in us make sure that we have information out, make sure that the community has access to the vaccine, make sure that we really mobilize the community to take the lead on how we confront this pandemic and get us to where we need to be going.
Speaking of which, I wanted to ask about the ability that organizations like Access have to go places. Folks may know that the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines require a rather elaborate and cold storage system, but I seem to remember that you had a mobile unit that you were using to take around for testing. If the FDA gets to a point of clearing providers to use the Johnson & Johnson vaccine again, is that something you would expect Access would use for distribution to try to reach people who maybe cannot or do not leave their homes?
Definitely. We will mobilize the mobile clinics again. We'll activate the mobile clinics again, this time to do the vaccine. And mentioning the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, it's really important to understand that there are communities, especially homeless communities, the people with disability, people with lack of mobility. This is a vaccine that the Johnson & Johnson that can be extremely helpful. So we will be activating the mobile clinics, in fact, in less than a week from now. And we hope that these mobile clinics will start to make a difference in terms of getting us to the 70%, 80% immunity.
So everyone is hoping for that right now. But as we've heard, some public health officials are starting to moderate their language in how they talk about that. Maybe we won't get to herd immunity. Maybe there are factors, you know, for people who can't overcome their hesitancy or who cannot navigate the system and we can't reach them through mobile units. What does your experience during the pandemic tell you about this? Do you think we are going to get back to something we recognize as normal?
First, April, I think we shouldn't give up on vaccinating as many people as possible. We still have populations who are having a hard time getting to a vaccine site or understand the information to where to go. We need to continue to seek out these people and really make sure we listen to what's going on in the community, make sure we mobilize the community. I doubt, April, that we will ever go back to where we were. And maybe we shouldn't go back to where we were. I think that there are big questions for us as a society: pollution, environment, healthcare, equity in healthcare. We need to seriously consider our future and seriously consider our priorities in terms of preventing what happened with this pandemic, preventing that from happening in the future.
Right. Hassan, I read recently that the stats on COVID in Arab and Muslim communities have been kind of tricky to pin down, since the U.S. Census still classifies folks with Middle East roots and North African roots as white. What's the consequence of that?
The consequences is we really don't know what's going on in the Arab American communities. We know what we know, April. We know we have more infection among Arab Americans coming to us because we are a community clinic. We know that among them, Arab Americans are having much more difficult time dealing with this pandemic, much more difficult time in terms of information. But the data is missing, April, because Arab Americans' population are lost in the white population. Although they may have unique needs and harder times, the state of Michigan is doing the best that they could do. But frankly, the data is not there. So it's been really challenging for us confronting this pandemic to know the damage that's been done in the Arab American community.
Yeah. We are, of course, in the final stretch of Ramadan. This is the second year that people have been encouraged to keep their festivities a little more physically distant and to think about the health of others as they're trying to celebrate. I just can't imagine how hard that is. What have you seen in folks trying to keep their family gatherings joyful, but still trying to keep each other safe?
You know, it's amazing. Ramadan, April, is about making sacrifices. It's about self-discipline. It's about reflecting. I'm seeing this year less of festivities and more of solidarity, more of understand how fragile we are as societies and as communities. Hopefully, this is the last Ramadan where we see the worst side of disease, and in the future we see more of festivities and happiness.
You have made an announcement that you're going to be stepping down after a very respectable tenure, 41 years as the head of Access. Why did you decide that this was the time to do this?
First April, I'm not gonna go away. I'm leaving my position. I'm staying as a consultant. I really wanna spend more energy on how do we develop the next generation of leadership? How do we connect a nonprofit organization with each other's, and also turn these organizations from service organizations to change makers. And I think nonprofit organizations are frankly the most now connected and probably the most powerful tools in making life better and making impact and changing societies. I think we could do that. I just want to spend some time figuring out how we could do this as a community.
Hassan Jaber is, until September, the president and CEO of Access, based in Dearborn. Hassan, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, April. It's always a pleasure talking to you.
If you are a fan of fungi, you probably already know this is morel hunting season. These delicate, spongy, rich mushrooms grow sometimes in front yards, but most often you'll find them in forests. There are other delicious bites to be had in the woods as well. Chives, ramps, fiddleheads, yes, even dandelions. And so begins a whole season of fun foraging. Not everything is edible in the forest, as all wise Michiganders know. And on public land, not everything that is edible is fair game. The state's Department of Natural Resources has a website to help you figure all this out, and Rachel Cole with DNR's Forest Resources Division joins us to sort through it. So morel mushrooms, I'm guessing, are pretty close to the top of the list that of what most people enjoy foraging for. But they do have an evil twin or two out there that look like morels, but that's actually poisonous. What do you tell people who ask you about how to know the morel from other mushrooms?
The first thing I tell people is do your research before going out. It can be pretty exciting to find something in the woods and, you know, put together a basket full of delightful mushrooms. But you want to do your research and make sure you know the differences between the different kinds of mushrooms before you just start picking them willy-nilly.
Are there edible mushrooms beyond morels that are common in Michigan state parks?
Sure. Some people go after chanterelle mushrooms. You've got chicken of the woods, pheasant backs. There are quite a few edible mushrooms in Michigan, but in terms of foraging, I'd say mushrooms are advanced. So you want to connect with someone who is experienced, maybe the first few times you go out, take you out, tell you the differences, and have a good ID resource.
You know, I have yet to find one either in the woods or at a farmer's market, but I really have to say that chicken of the woods is my favorite mushroom name in the history of mushroom names.
They are beautiful. If you haven't seen one before, they're this kind of great big orange shelf mushroom. And if you're walking through the woods and you see it, it's just like glowing at you.
You know, as I mentioned, there are several different types of habitats for mushrooms, and I suppose some of that depends on the kind of mushroom that we're talking about. But is there a mushroom habitat when people are thinking about going out? Like, what kinds of forests tend to be most hospitable for the stuff that people want to find?
That's a great question. I think it depends on the kind of mushroom you're looking for. Some of them grow on trees, some grow in the leaf litter, you know, some like different types of habitats, but generally, they start coming out in the spring after a good rain. You can see that the morels, we call it popping. You know, oh, they're going to pop up in the woods now. So in the terms of morels, definitely you look for somewhere usually with leafy trees, not conifer trees, and where there's some leaf litter on the ground and not too much growth yet in terms of other plants. They like their space.
How common is it for DNR to hear about folks foraging for things, mushrooms or otherwise, that end up being poisonous stuff to look out for? Is that something that happens every year?
I don't think we get a lot of calls on stuff like that. Mostly we get inquiries on, you know, where to look. People are excited and they, you know, they want to know how. So that's why we're trying to provide resources so people can forage safely and responsibly. But yeah, I haven't heard a lot about people necessarily getting into trouble, which is a good thing. But again, that reinforces the need to make sure that you properly ID something before you eat it. And even if you do properly ID it, some people might still have a reaction. So that's something to consider. So when you eat a mushroom, there's two things to think about. One, always cook it fully. And two, you know, really make sure you have it clean, you know where it's from, make sure it's not from somewhere where you've been spraying herbicides, and just take a little bite at first. Make sure you don't have a reaction.
You know, you mentioned that it's a good idea to hook up with somebody who knows their stuff the first time you go out and do this. I guess this mm-hmm. is a good reminder that foraging is probably a pretty pandemic-friendly activity if done properly.
Yeah, it's a great opportunity to get in touch with nature, get out, you know, and some fresh air, and you don't necessarily need to be in a crowded space to go and enjoy something and have fun.
It's probably better if it's not as crowded so things aren't so picked over.
Well, exactly.
Beyond mushrooms, what other fun spring or summer foraging can be had in the state parks and on public lands?
Sure. So on public lands, some of the things you can pick are tree fruits. You can look at nuts and berries. Again, berries are great entry level. They're very recognizable, and most of them don't have dangerous lookalikes. So coming into June, July, we're going to be seeing June berries, also called service berries. You know, we've got wild strawberries, then you're looking at blueberries, and then the bramble family later in the summer. So all sorts of tasty things to look for.
I was interested to hear you say nuts. What kind of nuts are native to Michigan?
So we have acorns, chestnuts, hazelnuts out in the woods, hickory nuts. Some of them can be a little harder to find and you have to know how to process them, but all very edible. I've had a fail with acorns before, but I'm going to try again.
Wait a minute. What is an acorn fail exactly? I need to hear this story.
Well, if you're looking at acorns, they can be a little bit bitter. So what I have learned is that you can eat them, but you really want to look for the acorns in the white oak family. And I chose red. So anyone who knows will know that the tannins are enough to make you pucker, kind of like a glass of red wine.
What edible things are off limits when we're out on public lands?
Sure. That's a good question. So on public lands, you don't want to take anything where you kill the plant. So I know they're very popular, but wild ramps, they can take up to 7 years to reproduce. So if you are cutting that plant, killing it, that is not okay. But if you have private land, you know, go for it. But just think about taking them sparingly since they don't regenerate very fast.
Right. Do you do a lot of forest foraging yourself?
It's something I've been getting into. I mean, I have, you know, great memories of going berry picking with my grandparents, or my dad has always, you know, taken me out morel hunting in the spring. So it's something that I've always been excited about. And working in forestry has taught me that a lot of people are really interested in this information. So as much as we can share safe and responsible foraging, that's something I'd like to do.
Yeah. Do you have a favorite preparation or recipe that you've discovered that you could tell us about?
Ooh, that's a great question. I think, honestly, the humble dandelion is something that is really exciting because you can eat almost every part of it. So when I see them pop in the spring, I think it's really exciting. A lot of people get mad when they see them in their yard, and I go, ooh, tasty. So, right?
So what do you do with your dandelions?
Sure. The greens, I really like to make a salad out of. They're a little bit bitter, so they're a bit like arugula. You can use them like that. You want to look for the small young ones. And the dandelion flowers, I have fried them like a fritter. They make a great crouton or something for dipping, or you can, if you have the experience, go ahead and make wine out of them.
Rachel Cole of the Department of Natural Resources Forest Resources Division. Rachel, thank you so much for your time. It's been fun talking to you.
Awesome. Thanks for having me.
Mushrooms have been used for thousands of years for therapeutic purposes. Some people seeking help for depression and anxiety are now exploring their psychedelic properties.
It's about you. It's about your healing process. It's about going deep into you and, you know, clearing out the cobwebs.
In a moment, we speak with one supporter of the legalization movement who coaches people through microdosing. Be right back. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Humans have used psychedelic substances in a variety of ways for a long, long time. Indigenous communities incorporated plant-based psychedelics like ayahuasca or psilocybin into religious or medicinal practices for hundreds, even thousands of years. In the 1960s, LSD and mushrooms, alongside marijuana, played a prominent part in the counterculture movement. And lately, more and more people in the United States are getting interested in possible health benefits of microdosing psychedelics. Everyone from people seeking help with medical conditions to Silicon Valley professionals wanting to improve their focus at work. Just to be clear, psychedelic drugs remain illegal at the federal level, but there's growing momentum to talk about changing that, including here in Michigan. Last September, the city of Ann Arbor decriminalized psychedelic plants and fungi, and one organization that worked on that effort is now hoping to decriminalize them statewide. As psychedelic use continues to become more commonplace, some entrepreneurs are building careers out of educating and even coaching people on the practice of microdosing. West Michigander Paul Austin is the founder of The Third Wave. It's an online resource for folks who are interested in learning more about psychedelic use and microdosing. He's also the author of Microdosing Psychedelics, A Practical Guide, and he joins us now. Paul Austin, welcome to Stateside.
Hey, April.
Paul, what do you think our society's perception of psychedelics is at this moment in the culture?
It's an emerging tool that can be very useful for healing an array of mental health challenges or issues or conditions that have proved to be previously intractable for the vast majority of people. Depression is now one of the leading causes of disability worldwide. Something like 300 million people have major depressive disorder that has undoubtedly gone up in the last year with COVID. And it looks as if psychedelics are catalytic in their healing potential. And instead of numbing us to, you know, what has caused us suffering or what has caused us pain, like many conventional psychiatric medications do, psychedelics actually open up a space in which we can face with courage what has previously proved to be difficult to accept and use it as a therapeutic tool to help with healing things like depression, alcoholism, end-of-life anxiety, PTSD, OCD, the list goes on and on. This is becoming more and more widely accepted. My mom, for example, works at Zeeland Community Hospital in West Michigan. She's a social worker, and she started receiving emails about conferences from her work that are related to ketamine-assisted psychotherapy and MDMA-assisted psychotherapy. And so that to me, says that within 3 to 5 years, this will be really a mainstream part of our medical model. And it, I think, will be part of an evolutionary next 10 years in which we'll see radical changes throughout society as a result of many of the things that we're now going through with COVID-19.
At the same time, there are a lot of people who may have never had any experience with psychedelics or who might have had, shall we say, a non-therapeutic experience with psychedelics that did not go as planned, who understand dosing more in the sense of overdosing or dosing incorrectly. Can you explain a little bit about how microdosing has gained some momentum as a therapeutic treatment?
So the inventor of LSD, Albert Hofmann, who invented LSD in 1938 and had the first ever LSD experience in 1943, towards the end of his life, talked about how he often used microdoses of LSD as sort of a euphorant or as something that was just helping with, you know, cognitive ability. And he lived to be 102. He was a very healthy man till the end of his life. And so this sort of got out into the space and, you know, word got to a man named James Fadiman, who's a psychologist, got his undergrad at Harvard, first took psilocybin in Paris with Ram Dass, who was Richard Alpert at the time, in the early 60s, and then went on to pioneer early stages of psychedelic research. And Mr. Fadiman is now, you know, in his 80s and has really been a pioneer in the psychedelic space from the second wave through the third wave. And so in 2011, he published a book called The Psychedelic Explorer's Guide, which is really a phenomenal manual on the art of responsible psychedelic use. And one of the chapters in that book was a chapter on microdosing, where he essentially surveyed his community, asked them to try out this thing where they would take low doses of psychedelics, about a tenth of a regular dose, 2 times a week for 5 weeks, and see how it went for them. And the sort of anecdotal results that he collected were really interesting. You know, writers would talk about how much easier it was to be articulate in what they wanted to say. And, you know, career professionals talked about how it really helped with sort of alertness and a positive mood at work. You know, other folks talked about how it helped them with certain mental health conditions for low mood or depression. So these were beautifully well-written reports, and they then basically informed for the next decade, 2011 until now, an incredible interest of research in this, because the predominant form of research around psychedelic substances was in high-dose clinical settings, largely in the 1950s and 1960s. There were thousands of clinical papers published on psychedelics, but unfortunately, because of the way that it sort of got out of control in the wider culture, there was a backlash. Essentially, people say we weren't quite ready for this now or at that point, but it was an opening, it was an awakening. And now a lot of those ideas that were birthed in the 50s and 60s from widespread psychedelic use that had been counterculture are now increasingly becoming sort of our mainstream culture. That is an exciting and optimistic development for a lot of folks who, you know, have been on SSRI medications or ADHD medications or other conventional psychiatric medications. And it's just unsatisfying. It helps sometimes, but usually the efficacy goes away. There can often be negative side effects, and they're quite addictive. They're very difficult to get off of. And microdosing psychedelics provide an opening to work with a substance that is healthier, that's better for you, that is anti-addictive, that helps with addictions. It's anti-inflammatory, helps to lower chronic inflammation in the body, which is very useful for healing, for depression. There's elements of neuroplasticity to it, et cetera, et cetera.
Paul, can I ask a question about process?
Sure.
In places that have started rethinking the regulation of psychedelics, one of the things that comes up early is the question of coaching or facilitators, people who can help folks who are interested in this as a therapeutic use. And I know that Third Wave offers a microdosing coaching package. That's one of the things that you do. Can you talk a little bit about why it's important to have a coach or someone in the mix and an outside perspective to help people with this?
Yeah, it's really the role of a guide, a caregiver, a healer, a therapist, a psychiatrist. They come in many forms and names, but ultimately their goal is to help guide someone into a deeper knowing in themselves, to become more coherent, to heal certain trauma that might be stored in the unconscious and the subconscious, and to do it in a way that guides someone to better outcomes, to more flow, to more creativity, to a better sense of presence, awareness, purpose, you know, more cognitive clarity, a number of benefits. And so having a coach, having a guide, someone who's sort of walked that path for you and understands how to work with these substances, because as you've mentioned, these substances, they're becoming widely destigmatized in many ways, and yet there are still a lot of misunderstandings about them. And so I think one of those is that although these are illegal, that they are useful and powerful tools, right? There's a reason they are illegal. There's a reason they've largely been used more in the underground historically. For thousands and thousands of years, there's something very threatening about widespread awareness in some ways. And this is how psychedelics have always been. So I think knowing someone who knows how to work with those powerful tools, who can help guide someone, who can be there for them. And sometimes that's clinical, you know, if it's a more therapeutic, you know, therapist, psychiatrist, counselor, clinical psychologist role, it's therapeutic. But more and more, and this has been my particular focus, it's on optimal outcomes. It's really looking at how can microdosing help with leadership development? How can it help with optimal well-being, with things like flow and creativity? And what does it say about people as they're starting to work with psychedelics in terms of both microdoses and also higher doses? How does that change the work that they choose to pursue even? And a lot of people are finding that they want to focus on things that are more about purpose, about giving back, about, you know, being in community. I see a lot of overlap between those who are working with psychedelics intentionally with a coach, with a guide, with a therapist, and choosing to pursue more fulfilling, aligned paths in life.
If you're just tuning in, I'm speaking with Paul Austin, a native of West Michigan, who's also the author of Microdosing Psychedelics, A Practical Guide. Paul, how were you first drawn to the microdosing experience?
So when I was 19, I did mushrooms with friends. And then about 5 months later, I did LSD in the woods on a beautiful May day. This was like last day of the school year. I went to Hope College, so everyone's drinking kegs and, you know, having a fun party with alcohol. And it's like, it's a party, but we were like, it's a really nice day. What if like five of us just took acid and went out to the beach? So we did that and it was stunning, beautiful, amazing, profound. And I had for a period afterwards, this afterglow effect where, you know, I felt a little more centered, a little like, oh, I want to meditate more often, eating healthier, cleaner, just making generally better decisions. Being more connected in relationships and friendships, less on my phone, you know, less in front of a computer. And I noticed this relationship between psychedelics and sort of growth, development, expansion, freedom. And then I started microdosing about 5 years later, where I had those early opening experiences with high doses of psychedelics, beautiful afterglow effect. And then I'm building my first business, online coaching business, to help people learn English and pass standardized tests for English, and sort of microdosing to help with more flow and creativity, and also just help to, you know, let go of some social anxiety. I stopped drinking for the most part alcohol and just started to microdose with small amounts of psychedelics instead.
How do you describe the difference between the recreational experience and the therapeutic experience?
So the therapeutic experience, I would say, is oftentimes much more personal. It's about you. It's about your healing process. It's about going deep into you and, you know, clearing out the cobwebs. That's the more therapeutic experience. Now, the therapeutic experience can still be done in groups. So both are done in groups, both therapeutic and recreational can be. But the therapeutic is much more zen. It's much more keep to yourself, quiet time. Recreational, I would consider to be more like, you know, you're looking to go for a beautiful 3-hour hike somewhere with a close friend or your partner, and you decide to take a microdose of mushrooms or even a higher dose. And, you know, you plan a day and you bring a playlist and you bring a little food and water and you go out for a beautiful day together. So that I would consider to be recreational, but still incredibly therapeutic and healing and beautiful and profound in its own way. And the recreational I find to be more about interrelational connections, like connecting with other people and using these medicines as ways to bond and understand one another and connect with one another.
You know, since this is an entirely new area in terms of places in the U.S. loosening regulations. You know, there's some people who have safety concerns about what's going on. What's on your mind about the kind of training that coaches and facilitators and guides should have?
So they need to be trained in how to listen. They need to be trained in how to empathize, trained in how to work with these substances in higher doses, microdoses, also things like breath work. You know, they should have some training and understanding of things like yoga or diet. You know, it's a really integrative practice. And more than anything, a willingness to love and be open and to hold space for someone who's going through a very, very difficult experience. Now, depending on the need of the patient, so if they are a clinical patient, if they have depression or PTSD, you know, a psychiatrist, a therapist, someone who's clinically trained is going to be ideal for those types of people. And I would say that's about 20% of folks. But for the 80%, you know, basically the other 80%, it doesn't necessarily need to be a clinical professional. It can be someone who is a good friend. It could be someone who, you know, who's a great listener, who's done a lot of coaching, potentially certifications, who has an active practice themselves. And that's a growing network of practitioners, you know, who are not necessarily focused on the clinical side of things, but they're focused on non-clinical outcome. They're focused on leadership and flow and creativity, these elements of positive psychology of growth and expansion. Because oftentimes the initial process with psychedelics is healing, right? There's mm-hmm. often for many, or if not all of us, elements to explore of the shadow, elements to explore what needs to be healed, what needs to be, you know, come up from the subconscious and the unconscious. But for those of us who have either done this or had other practices, these are phenomenal tools for like these expanded states of being, which are just so connected, so beautiful. They feel very artistic. There's an incredible aesthetic to them. It's really these, you know, heartwarming, beautiful experiences. And that's always been my orientation. And then, you know, how do we take those experiences that just fill us with so much bliss and joy and profound gratitude for this experience, that we carry that energy through into other elements and areas of our lives, you know, the work that we do, the relationships that we hold, right? We hold ourselves to a really high standard of awareness mm-hmm. in a way. And that to me is what I find to be fascinating about the coaches element. So coaches, facilitators, absolutely necessary. And depending on the needs of the patient who's being guided, sometimes clinical, sometimes more towards creativity, leadership, flow, optimal well-being.
Have you ever run across someone who maybe you felt wouldn't benefit from this? Like, have you ever had to say to someone, this might not be a good fit for you, or you had to steer them elsewhere?
Yeah. So as one of the first project I started, Third Wave, which is an online platform, which you had mentioned before, I also started a retreat center in the Netherlands called Synthesis, because psilocybin truffles are legal in the Netherlands. I spoke at a couple conferences in Europe, met a Dutch co-founder, and we opened a beautiful place. And we kept it specifically on non-clinical, because neither of us had clinical backgrounds as the co-founders. We hired and brought in early on a therapist and a medical doctor to be there, but we also, anyone who applied who we knew had a medical condition or was on certain medications, we screened out and had to say no to. Now that's changing for them now. They've built out a clinical team. We brought on investment. You know, it's like that's been necessary. And that's what's so important about doing this. It's really understanding what are your limits, to what depth can you hold people? And at that point in time, we both said, you know, what we want to start can be purely wellness oriented. We're not prepared yet for the clinical side of things, because there's a lot more challenge and difficulty in that. There's a lot more messiness in it. There needs to be a lot more care and attention. On a more broader base, people who are predisposed to schizophrenia or other personality disorders. And I have friends who have healed schizophrenia through psychedelic use, and it is also very risky unless you're working with someone who has done it themselves before or who is trained in it. So more often, psychedelics are used for rigidity and sort of a tightening of the default mode network, and that rigidity is more associated with depression, addiction, these sorts of things. The people who are already open, who have already seen through the veil, so to say, like someone who might identify with a schizoid condition, they're better off not using psychedelics. And then there's also other small little things. There's a great company that just got up and going that's doing psychedelic genetic test kits. That's called Halugen. And Halugen, you can buy a test kit from them, and then it'll do a genetic test to see, is it okay if you work with psychedelics? Or do you have something that means you shouldn't, like some sort of gene? and they can now test that. So I think that's a great starting resource for a lot of the people who want to do this, but I want to make sure it's safe and, you know, they don't have any sort of underlying condition, because I think that will be a lot more people, especially in non-clinical settings. It will become very easy fairly soon to simply grow your own mushrooms at home. And we're already seeing widespread decriminalization, not only of psilocybin mushrooms, but of all drugs. And I think that will only accelerate in the next 10 years.
Paul Austin, thank you so much for talking to us about this.
You're welcome. Thank you, April.
And that's Stateside for today. I'm April Baer. Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you on Wednesday.